This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome, Monday Night Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education, the number 855-752-4842. We hope that's the number, 855-752-4842. Special guest tonight, The Schools Our Children Deserve, Punished by Rewards. His books have been out there. Progressive educator, you know, extraordinaire, Alfie Cohn. Alfie Cohn, welcome to Busted Pencils. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on again.
So, Alfie, let's get right to it because we only have you for a short time. The newest blog piece at alfiecohn.org is Cognitive Load. People are thinking about this. I was explaining this to somebody saying, well, you know, humans have memories, and memories are kind of fundamental when we're talking about learning. So wouldn't it make sense then to say that there's only so much we can hold in our memory or learn until we have to quit and give room for something else? Is that a good description of, I'm not saying it's the accurate, but is that the way cognitive load kind of functions?
Yes, the concept posits that our limited working memory means that we can't move but so much information over to permanent memory. And traditionalists in education who have been urging the abolition of progressive approaches to learning that involve students at the center and active inquiry and discovery in favor of direct instruction have been using this concept of cognitive load for a while in order to disparage progressive education as unworkable and saying, in effect, kids can't, they don't have enough working memory to be able to learn things well when they have to encounter new concepts and construct them on their own. So we should just show the problems already solved and tell them how to do it step by step. But as I argue in the blog piece, there are numerous serious problems with applying this cognitive load theory at much less than just the eye.
The traditionalists, let's put it out there, this is traditionalists who are saying, you know, darn it, there's only so much we can tell kids. And the biggest thing is that we should only tell them very explicitly exactly what they need to know, because anything outside of what they need to know might clog up their brains and therefore hinder learning. That's kind of like the idea of cognitive load in there. But, you know, Alfie, we've, you know, all over the years with Busted Pencils, we've talked about this. When it comes to learning, can you just tell us the idea of constructivist learning, the idea of a progressive, and I hate these labels, but the idea of saying learning is more than just filling up somebody's brain. What happens when kids and people, when humans learn?
Well, if learning means understanding ideas, I like to say, from the inside out, then an active role for the person learning it is not an avoidable aspect. It's not a peripheral aspect of the process. It's a description of how people do learn. Constructivism is a description. It's not just a prescription. Now, the people on the other side here who talk about direct instruction and cognitive load construe learning as a very mechanical process of acquiring new sequences of skills in, for example, solving an algebra problem or a bunch of facts that are going to be stored in memory. And much of the research on what's effective helping kids learn that says, for example, kids should test themselves, they're supposed to do well, and so on, is based on this very limited mechanical truncated understanding of what learning is about. So, for example, almost all of the studies done that supposedly show this threat of cognitive load and the superiority of direct instruction are based on mechanical problems that have one right answer and one correct pathway to get that answer. Mm. And the studies also tend to show very short-term effects. When you start thinking about learning in a broader sense, first of all, inquiry and student-centered learning turns out to be far more effective on those more ambitious criteria than direct instruction. And secondly, cognitive load doesn't present a problem, and a higher load is often actually a good thing. Even if kids don't get the right answer then, they are learning skills that they're able to transfer to new kinds of problems, and particularly lifelike, open-ended problems, they may not have one right answer.
I wonder if what happens, though, is with any of the traditionalist approach, we typically try to come across as like it's a commonsensical approach. And so kind of playing on the idea of like, I really got deep into something, I was really learning, and it got to the point where I had to take a break. And so I think that's what cognitive load means then. That makes sense, that there's only so much at certain points. And so me as an individual human, I know occasionally I need to take a break. Therefore, cognitive load must be a truth. However, what you point out, though, too, in the blog is going, yeah, Tim, maybe for you, cognitive load might be at a certain level, I don't know, a mile long. And maybe for Johnny, it's 2 miles long. The idea of saying what cognitive load is, we can't even really measure it because individually humans are very different.
Right. And it doesn't just vary by individual. It varies by the kind of task and the kind of situation you're in, the whole cultural context, and many other considerations. In real life, when we feel like it's too much, we allow ourselves more time, or we mm-hmm. write stuff down so we don't have to remember every aspect of the sequence. Or we learn in different ways and provide this kind of scaffolding for our students or for ourselves. But the studies that claim to show cognitive load as this onerous problem that requires direct instruction are extremely contrived in preventing students from having access to those off-ramps. And yeah, so it looks they just can't handle inquiry when that's not really the case. The vast majority of progressive educators don't leave kids all by themselves to solve everything on their own. They provide guidance. That's a mm-hmm. cartoon version of progressive education that the traditionalists use to make their own top-down, teacher-centered, traditional approach look better or necessary. And I dug deep into the research to show when we understand inquiry-based or progressive learning in its proper real context, the way it's done in classrooms, that the research shows it's far more effective, especially when you want to look more meaningful.
And that's the part.
Like, are kids able to understand it, to apply it in new context? And how do they feel about what they're learning? The whole cognitive load contingent ignores the student as autonomous agent, pays no attention to whether kids want to learn what's been given to them, which also makes a huge difference in how much you seem able to make use of and what you're able to do effectively.
Johnny Lupinacci, jump in there, my friend. I see you nodding away.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just like that we have this discussion for our listeners to hear, you know, about this, because as we, you know, are always talking about different ways that we may improve instruction or address the so-called learning loss. I mean, we are very critical of that, you know, on the show, and our callers and guests have spoken, you know, hey, kids are learning, but there is this push to kind of apply best practices and to hear sort of cognitive load theory a little bit, like have it debunked here by Alfie tonight is really helpful, because if you're out there listening and you've heard like, hey, we should try this, you know, cognitive load theory tells us we should really be just giving kids the solution and step by step, you know, they'll learn better that way. Hold up. You know, we have something to say about that. And Alfie joins us here tonight to kind of lay out this myth that cognitive load theory you know, is somehow a best practice.
And so the response to that claim about cognitive load is the same as the response to learning loss claims that we've talked about on past episodes. What do you mean by learning? There will be loss of memorized information. That is always going to happen. And there's research showing how much it happens. But if by learning you mean the capacity to, for example, think about the effect of your writing on a reader or what mathematical concepts mean rather than a memorized sequence of practices, procedures, algorithms, that doesn't get lost. So the main pushback for so much research and conservative advocacy in education is to pull up onto the table under the light where you can see it, the implicit premises about what constitutes learning and what the ultimate goal is.
I love that. You know, what constitutes learning? Really thinking about what do we mean by when we're focusing on learning and how important it is that we really think critically about that assertion. Hey, we're here to teach and children are learning. Well, are we teaching in a way that allows for the kind of learning that we're talking about, the three of us here today?
Well, and that's the learning too. We've talked about this, and you know, and Alfie for the longest time started off as a guest on Busted Pencils, the podcast, and we talked about this, the kind of why there's constantly this argument to want to deny rich learning, investigative inquiry, the kind of learning where kids are excited, the kind of learning where teachers can dig in and not feel like they're just being told to follow the script. It's still, you know, we're only about 2 minutes left with you, Alfie, but I'm like, why do you think about the, why does this hold such a sway on people to say, but back in the day when I just was taught the way I was taught, things were better, and this inquiry stuff is just a bunch of liberal crap. Like, what is it that makes people hold on to such a very simple type of way of looking at the world?
Well, it's harder to understand and it's harder to do well. It's also more subversive of the status quo, not only within schools, but within society in general. When you talk about students constructing meaning for themselves and with one another, now you're talking about collaboration instead of individualism and competition. Now you're talking about questions that can expand to raise queries about why all sorts of institutions in our society are set up the way they are. And not everybody wants kids to be critical thinkers, even if they pay lip service to that idea.
But that's what we want here. Busted Pencils, our guest, Alfie Cohn. Thanks, Alfie, for Busting Pencils. See you next time. Come back for a minute. Welcome back. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. It's a Monday night. Had to get a quick interview segment in there. Special guest, Alfie Cohn. He has been at the forefront, Johnny, of saying, you know, I mean, since the late 80s, his first, you know, one of the first books that Alfie pointed out that, you know, was The Case Against Competition. And I remember that when that came out, that people were just like, wait a minute, competition is great for learning. That's how everybody gets better. And Alfie kind of threw out all of the research that went, well, not really. If you want to talk about learning in the sense of how people learn, and over the next three decades had spent, you know, a large portion of everything he did laying out the schools our kids deserve, punished by rewards, pointing out all of this from the standpoint of saying, sorry, there's just not a research base out there that supports this kind of traditionalist behaviorism. And as we were just getting there towards the end of the interview, I was kind of saying, what is it that holds such power over people and the decision to say, I want very traditional learning to take place. And in fact, the learning loss arguments, all of these things, they're all wrapped up together in this very, and I'm going to say it, a very politically conservative viewpoint. And Alfie was just starting to hint at that. And the idea of going, well, when you start bringing people together to collaborate, to work in groups, to bring diversity to the forefront, all of a sudden, you're moving in a direction that may allow for people to start thinking on their own. And the reality is, Tim, that's what we're really against. We don't like people thinking. Is it too simple, Johnny?
No, I think that's an important angle to have on it. But I also want to emphasize, I think what Alfie's reminding us here is that we don't want to oversimplify and have students trained to look for the one right answer. I mean, this is not, again, we had callers last week talking about the importance of like reality, teaching about teaching skills, teaching content connected to skills we use often in our lives and in different career paths. The example being the use of a tape measure, right? So, you know, I think one of the really important takeaways from our expert guest tonight is that, you know, one, be weary of these big pushes that simplify education. It's a complex thing. And that's a wonderful thing. It's an art. It's a craft. Quality teachers know this, right? Our guest Alfie Conanite said, you know, really good progressive educators aren't just letting kids do whatever, right? And they're also not telling them, here's the answer, work backwards from that. You know, there is a lot of guided and instruction and practice that goes to keeping an open inquiry and developing the capacity that there's more than one way oftentimes to do something, but there are right answers, right? And so there's this balance, like we don't want to oversimplify something messy and complex and beautiful like a classroom, like learning. So we also, you know, talk tonight about, remember, one of the original reasons why we have, you know, Dr. Alfie Cohn on when we do is because he is an expert on this reframing what we mean by learning. Like, yes, we want discipline in our classrooms, but we don't want to punish kids by, you know, rewarding them with things. So punished with rewards or these myths that, you know, he's debunked over the years that, you know, we just do more drill and kill, more direct instruction and more tests. And that in itself will mean higher learning. That will be, you know, higher achievement. All that does is maybe raises some scores, and those scores
what Alfie points out. Sorry, Johnny, jumping in there, but what Alfie points out, it may raise scores in the short term potentially, but actually over the long term studies,
really narrow bracketed way of saying, here's how we're going to measure success or intelligence. You know, here are these test scores. Well, that's, you know, fine and dandy because we can manipulate instruction to stack those test scores, but that's not good learning and it's not good teaching. So it kind of loops us back into, you know, we had guests a few weeks ago talking about the predictability of test scores, right? And that they could predict students' standardized test scores based on socioeconomic status and a number of factors external to the school, right? But what we know is when we stack the deck to measure a particular thing and then teach to that thing, we can raise the number. But is the goal really raising this arbitrary number? Absolutely not. It's the practical application of content. And so when you say short-term, long-term, it's really all terms, because, you know, like I can teach you a lesson in a way where I'm guaranteeing on a multiple choice quiz at the end of the week, you're going to get the right answer. Maybe it's saying, how do you make tea? And like we go over the steps. Maybe I even sit you down with a cup of tea and you drink the cup of tea and I give you a list of how I made that tea. Right. And then I drill and kill all week long that the choices are, one, you know, what is the first step in boiling tea? It's boiling water. It's boiling water, right? And I tell you all week long, the first step to making tea is boiling water. And I say, Tim, you drank a cup of tea. Cool. And on Friday, you got the right answer. What is the first step to making tea? You boil the water. You bubble it in. You got it right. And I clap my hands, you know, and I praise you. And then I go to sleep at the end of the week saying, man, Tim, my student, he really knows how to make tea. The problem is Tim doesn't know how to make tea. He just knows that the first step is to boil water. And then he started the lesson by tasting some tea. So he's tasted the tea. He's got the final product and he has the answer to the question I might ask at the end of the week. That's all he has.
But maybe what Alfie was saying, though, too, is me going, I don't know, what, Johnny, you know why? I don't like tea. I don't care from on Monday when you started talking about tea, Mr. Lupinacci. I didn't care to pay attention because I don't like tea anyway. And in fact, why are you boiling water? I get tea at the restaurant. I don't need to make it at home. So
and that's not the answer on the test at the end of the week. So, you know, we're going to move on to something else that's loaded into the test questions. And that's we're making fun of the fact that too often the test becomes the sort of authority on what we're teaching. And we focus more on how are we ensuring that students get that right answer? And what thankfully we know is that students have a bunch of questions. Like Tim asked, what is tea? Okay, great. I taste it. What's in there? Where'd it come from? Why do we boil it? Why don't we do something else? What about if I get my hot water from something else? Or where we have those more open-ended.
What about sun tea?
Yeah, right. So those are the kinds of great questions that good learning spaces should have. They're messy. You know, we're making light of it because it's something like making tea because it's what popped into my head. But, you know, in general, we can do this around fractions. We could do this around identifying adjectives in a sentence, you know, or reading comprehension, right? We want it to be open-ended to a certain degree, that there are facts and truths, there are right answers, but there are a number of ways to get there. And what's really important is the process, that we're engaged in the process.
And so often, so many times, the process is actually, and this is what Alfie Cohn was pointing out, it's actually the process that gets attacked a lot of the times as we're talking about, quote, you know, learning in the depth. You know, Johnny, when come back though, too, I want to just explore this a little bit further, because the idea, even if remembering things is the goal, that actually there's really good research on if you want to remember things, there are better ways than direct instruction and cognitive load. It's Busted Pencils. It's Fully Leaded. When we get back, we're going to teach you how to remember. You're always bending to my direction, Johnny's direction, producer Anya's direction, Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, educated educators talking education. The number, there is no number right now tonight.
You tried to call, you know, you might have found you got routed to the direct line at the station. That's okay. We're working on fixing it. But in the meantime, you know, if you want to send a message, you could send one in the chat, or you could send one if you're watching the live feed through text. Otherwise, if you did try and call and you got, you know, kind of the automated system that isn't the live radio show, give us a call tomorrow. We'll definitely have it resolved by then, if not by the end of the show.
Johnny Lupin, call tomorrow. The Alfie Cohn questions, call tomorrow, because, you know, Tuesday, typically trending education news, democratic core values, civics. You know, we talked about civics lessons. And so anybody who wants to come in with the cognitive load discussion and learning. Johnny, though, I was talking about this from the, you know, right before we went to the break there, coming back in, though, if memory is the goal, one of the goals of learning, remembering, right? Yeah. I mean, we say any traditional my neighbor typically remembers that when he was in school, he was asked to remember things. Like, that's what tests were about remembering things. And so he studied to remember things. And so memory, the you know, and that's a short way to talk about learning. However, when we do use that simple construct of remembering something, here's the best part that I really like about Alfie's research, not Alfie's research, but his review of the research on learning, not Alfie doing him looking at all of the studies over time and time and time again. If you want kids in a school to remember things for a long time, study after study after study shows inquiry-based progressive learning, active learning creates longer term memory for students on issues such as facts. So even if facts are the only things that matter to you, if you want to teach kids to remember facts for a long time, don't direct instruction and memorize them just for the test, but engage them deeply in the acquisition of that knowledge. And the ability to remember facts actually increases when you are not part of a direct instruction, but inquiry progressive types of discovery learning. That was my point, Johnny Lupinacci.
Well, yeah, it's a good one. It helps break it down because, like, let me just play a perspective here for a second, because I think it's an important balance, and this is not an argument for why we need only direct instruction, but when we hear that, when we hear the critique of direct instruction, we think, well, wait a minute. Sometimes don't teachers need to just teach things? And so we want to be really clear when I think the point you're making, Tim, is that there is moments where we directly teach, but direct instruction being this idea that, like, you're given the step-by-step of everything. You're told, like, this is the list of words you need to memorize. These are words that are gerunds, or these are words that are adverbs. Memorize the list, right? And then, or memorize the rule or the formula in math class. Like, this is how you find the radius of a circle. Memorize it, right? And if we only, you know, show you it and tell you to memorize it, and in fact practice memorizing it in that sense, it, you know, what you're saying is that that's kind of a commitment to direct instruction that doesn't follow what we know about learning, and that if I was to explain the process but also tell you, here is how you find the radius, let me show you, and then have you ask questions, sort of play with it a little bit, try it a few times on your own, make some mistakes, right, get some feedback on those, some direct feedback on those mistakes and on that process, that you might actually remember the formula for finding the radius of the circle better than if you just plain memorized it.
That's what I'm saying, and I used to do this when I was working with.
Yeah, Tim. So what I wanted you to clarify is part of the jargon is, like, we're saying, you know, when in fact direct instruction isn't the best practice. We're referring to the idea of where all I do is present you the information and have you memorize it and put it into a short answer or a test or apply it on a worksheet. It leaves out all of that other exciting stuff that does require a direct instructor. It has somebody kind of facilitating it and asking you, yeah, keep asking more questions. Hey, looks like you're on to something there. What'd you do? Yeah, that's not the radius, huh? What mistake did you make? Right? Mm-hmm. And you have that kind of time with it. So I just wanted to clarify for listeners, because I know on the outside, I always heard this, you know, critique of direct instruction. And I thought, when I was first teaching, I thought, oh no, I'm doing so much explaining. I'm hovering over some of these students, even though I'm saying, hey, keep on that. Like, good on you. Keep on that. Like, what's a question you have? Like, I'm poking them to stay in the inquiry, right? And to explore. I always felt like, man, I'm being direct with my instruction because I was thinking of it more in terms of one-on-one or me in the class working through something. But what Alfie and you all are talking about is when the teacher just says, here's the knowledge, learn it, and then I'm here to evaluate whether or not you retained it.
I wonder if certain content, though, too, even that, and I wonder if you're talking more about math, because when I was an elementary social studies history teacher, and then when I taught elementary students who were going to be elementary school teachers how to teach history, I used to make this point to them, too, that saying, okay, you know, I would give them the basic facts test of American history. These are 20-year-olds in college, right? They have passed U.S. history in elementary school. They have passed U.S. history in middle school. They have passed it usually in high school, and they've usually taken at least one, if not two, American history courses before they got to me, and I would give them a basic test of American history facts, and they'd all fail. Just about every single one of them would fail, and I'd say, how is it possible that you have been taught this thing so many times that you cannot remember George Washington? You cannot remember, and they're just like, well, because, Tim, when I learned it back then, I only learned it for that moment, and then it moved on, and I didn't commit it to my long-term memory. And I was like, okay, that's an interesting observation. is it because the content was tough or things like that? They're like, no, it was just because I only was told exactly what I had to know, when to know it, and then when to put it down, and then I dropped it out. And I said, wouldn't it be neat if you remembered some of those things? And if we did that, how could you put some of these events, and in fact, U.S. history, knowledge of U.S. history, remembering more facts. If you want to produce a longer-term memory of facts, don't tell kids the day Washington crossed the Delaware. Engage them in the conversation of why did he cross the Delaware? What happened? What was going on that night crossing the Delaware? What were the Prussian soldiers doing over there sitting across on the river? What was engaging? Why was this risky? Why did this change so many things in the war? Guess what? Remembering Washington crossing the Delaware becomes a lot more something that you access in the future, as opposed to just telling students the date. So like any of these things. And I think that's why I was saying, is it the content sometimes? Because boy, when it comes to remembering history and facts, I think a lot of people will point out and go, ah, I learned it back then, but I don't remember it now. And I would ask so many times, well, how did you learn it? They'd say, well, we just read about it in the book. You know, we did the main ideas. We had some study questions, then we moved on. So you never really engaged in the whys of history. You never engaged in the exploration. You never debated two different points of view. Like, no, never, Tim. That's my point.
Yeah, and the evidence that we have, right, is that even if you learned it, say, matter of fact, like with explicit direct instruction, even if when it was measured, like the test you took, you did well on.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean, and actually we know it doesn't guarantee that you will remember it long term. You've just put it in a short term memory space. And so if the goal is lasting learning, like to bring it back to that content, like states and capitals, remember that? Like mm-hmm. You learned all the state capitals and you could just rattle them off. I mean, I guarantee most people who only learned it as like, here's the list of states and capitals, put them on flashcards, go. Like they pass that test and they maybe no longer know where those states or capitals are alone. But versus if we're saying, how far away are we from these other places? Where are they on the map? How long would it take if we drove? Which capitals are within 10 hours of our location, right? And we do some learning around those places actually relating or having connection to the person, they might end up in the long term, right, memory bank, versus if we just memorized them and went forward. Sometimes you have to use memory, but when you don't attach it to something that's more guided or sparks an inquiry, then it's just kind of going to sit there in that short term.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the fear, right? Is, you know, what, not a fear, but the idea, and I always get really critical. I'm gonna, you know, kind of putting this around U.S. history. So much of the criticism about what, you know, the kind of like the Jay Leno on the street, you know, the making fun of what people don't know about U.S. history, as if that was some kind of a statement on, you know, the character and the nature of the citizenship of students, you know, typically college students, they would say they just don't know their American history. And I would say, yeah, they don't. And in fact, guess what? The majority of the population laughing at Jay Leno on the sidewalk, making fun of these people, don't know the answers to those questions either, because none of us remember any of those things because we didn't have to. And geez, you know what? After 10 years and somebody throws a random quote fact at you, the reality is that there's a good chance. And I typically say this, guess what the standard score on an eighth grade U.S. history test is for 20 to 40 year olds? 50%. 50% is the standard score of people of an eighth grade U.S. history test taken when you're 20, 30, and 40 years old. Almost everybody scores 50% or less. And so you sit there and go, so 50% of the population doesn't know 50% of American history. I don't know if that's what that means. I think what it means is that we didn't do enough when it came to teaching U.S. history to really honor the learning process in the depth of how people engage with content and can dig deeply. And in fact, it's more of a statement about how we approached the teaching of something and where we made its importance that typically results in, quote, a test years later of somebody's memory of what they learned from years ago.
Yeah, Tim. So it sounds like to me, one of the things you're saying here is that it takes more time to do this meaningful learning stuff, but it's actually worth it. And then you're also saying, hey, when we're laughing at these jokes, that these sketches about like how, you know, smart or not smart general public out there is, that actually it's telling to our education system. Like we all knew this stuff at one point. How come we don't remember it anymore? And what, where and why weren't we learning it in ways that made it applicable so that it stayed with us? If it's so important, why isn't it something that we can remember? And it's because how we learned it didn't align with the science that says you want students to remember this when they're grown and citizens and apply it. Hold on, you better do things a little bit different. And that takes a little more time. Dare we say that the test isn't the reason why we would be learning these things,
right?
Then we can take more time to learn them in more meaningful ways and say, maybe we should pay less attention to that test being the goal. And let's spend some more time doing that creative and that kind of learning that lends itself to long-term memory and application. Oh boy, Tim, it sounds like we're saying that test isn't the best thing.
I'm saying that, and I'm just saying like this, guess what? If you want to make something memorable, well then darn it, make it memorable, make it engaging, make it exploratory, make it critical, make it fun. Yeah, people are like, you mean make learning fun? Yes, even that, fun. I want it to be fun. I want you to engage it. I want it to be difficult. I want it to be rich, because without that, you're not going to remember anything. Anybody have memories? What do you remember? You remember wonderful, awesome things. We're going to remember more of that when we get back. Yes. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Started off the show with Alfie Cohn. Yes, that Alfie Cohn, progressive educator extraordinaire. Research, it's been out there. He's been looking at all of the research on learning for well over 30 years, continues to point out that, hey, look, if you're oversimplifying it, it's probably not true. And in this sense, this whole idea of cognitive load, kind of bringing it back to my neighbor. My neighbor is saying, Tim, I just want schools to create better learning for the kids. And Johnny, that's what we're talking about. If you want to create better learning, well, then typically learning things, a lot of people associate that with things I remember. And if I remember something, it typically made an impact. Well, then that's a good example to say, my guess is that if you remember something, it was probably not force-fed down your throat for you to only remember it once on a test. Something that creates a long-term memory, something that you remember, is typically a much more engaging. And so the idea of making a pitch for saying, man, so learning's a little bit more kind of complicated and or messy or juicy. What's the better word, Johnny?
I mean, I think meaningful, right? And things that are meaningful often take time and they take connection, right? And they are very situational and contextual, and so they can't be universalized. They can't be reduced into, well, here is the same experience that every single, you know, fifth grader is going to have. It's going to look different and feel different and maybe even be about a slightly different example or topic. Yet we can have sort of common learning goals. How we do it needs to have that creativity and flow that puts trust in good teachers, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what I feel happens when we get to this big picture of, you know, of saying, let's speed it up. Let's make sure everyone's learning more faster. And in fact, if we do it this way, insert things like cognitive load theory or direct instruction, we can be more efficient with it. And look, the results are there. So yeah, we've sort of cooked up a scenario where we make a case for expensive materials that have a really quick, you know, a result that isn't that isn't necessarily tied to the goal. What I mean, so like, these are like firecracker methods or like firecracker, you know, curriculums or lessons. They have a big flash and then they're gone. And so that big flash being, look, they just got the right answer on the test, or they just got a really good test score, but nobody can apply the knowledge. And and in fact, they say, well, we should teach it this other way. I said, well, that's going to take up a lot of time. And then and then I say, well, that's time well spent. The counter argument to that, well, this might be time well spent, is we don't have time for that because the kids are going to fall behind, which is another myth that we keep pulling up, is that learning loss. No one's falling behind. In fact, they're just going to learn more stuff they're going to forget. So why are we piling on more that's going to be forgotten or not able to be recalled in a way to apply it? Then it's useless. And so then we make that argument. If we're not to be useless in public education, then we demand that we slow things down and emphasize that meaning-making, that meaningful moment, right? Mm. That requires a quality teacher, you know, in good conditions with students who are cared for and taken care of in the community are able to learn, and we have to slow things down to get there. So I'm all for that, Tim. I mean, if we're going to really, you know, focus on that meaning making, it's going to take some time.
Yeah. Right?
But I think it's time well spent.
It's going to take some time, but I think, as you pointed out there, Johnny, you know what, though? We've got time. Kids are in school for a long time. They're in, you know, they're in classrooms. They're sitting in front of us. The idea that somebody says, you know, we don't have time for that. No, we actually have lots of time to make meaning, which you're talking about, Johnny. The reality would be saying, in fact, I would say we have a lot of time to make meaning. If you're not developing those deep meaning-making skills, that's a waste of time. Instead, though, that gets thrown out as that's the efficient way to cover lots of material over shorter amounts of time. And the reality is that actually, from an efficiency standpoint, or when we say measuring memories, if you want to measure memories long-term, then actually the efficiency mechanisms, those faster, more. No, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so slowing things down, taking time to dig deep, to do meaningful. Johnny, I'm going to throw this out there too. In fact, maybe even not buying the latest product out there. Just saying, the potential that high, you know, what are these, you know, these instructional materials, you know, the research proven teaching materials. Typically that means somebody's trying to sell something that undermines teaching and learning, because it actually takes away the complexity and says, you know what, if people are turning these things and you just don't have the high quality instructional materials, the right high quality instructional materials will fix everything. You're like, no, typically that just means we're trying to sell something to create more efficiencies. And if you're creating more efficiencies, I'm going to guarantee most of the time those efficiencies typically result in more profits for people outside of education and less learning for students, and way more demoralization for kids and teachers too. I'm just kind of wrapping it all together like that, Johnny.
Well, Tim, I'm going to ask you then, man, because, you know, we've been debating this between you and I, and we've had different guests on, and we'll have some more coming up who will definitely have something to say about this. And when the phone lines are working, I know Joanne calls in and talks about this when we start going at it. But Tim, does that mean you're saying we shouldn't buy the technology to have AI in all of our classrooms?
Oh my, you went there? Really?
No, you
really
love AI. You love AI.
So, hey, I'm not sure that AI is a technology you have to buy, although I'm going to have to be pondering that. I don't know. Johnny kind of throwing it at me right there.
You don't have reality, a laptop ready for me for my classroom with AI programs loaded on it?
I'm not sure AI has been listed as a high quality instructional material. Ah, well. tomorrow night, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. We're going to get back. Yeah, civics, democracy, and the phone lines back open. See y'all tomorrow night.